Radio, where gamers roll. www.d20radio.com.
Hello and welcome to the Knowledge Check Podcast, a D&D 5th edition discussion podcast. I am one of your hosts, Eric.
And I'm your other host, Philip.
And welcome to another episode of the Knowledge Check, where this week we are going to be starting a kind of series. Probably we'll do these types of episodes again, where we visit classic D&D monsters. And this week, what are we doing, Philip?
Dragons. Rawr. It's half the name of the game.
Next week we'll be discussing dungeons. No.
We need a lot of episodes for that. Yeah.
Yes, we are going to be diving into dragons, going over kind of the flavor of them in various cultures and campaign settings and fictional archetypes, and also how to use them in your campaign and as a player in a variety of ways. So before we get into all that, Philip, the social media plug.
They can find us. Everyone can find us on all of the media's social.
Indeed.
Actually, media is already plural. So, all media social. We are on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. I think there's actually a Google Plus page.
Could you say that our social media is in media res?
Yes, I suppose you could say that.
One could.
Well, I don't know. Is someone actually making use of it at this very moment?
Let me check. Yes. Okay.
Yeah. Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, Google+. You can contact us on Gmail. And on all of these things, we are the Geek Pantheon.
Mm-hmm.
So on any social media that you like, if you look for us at The Geek Pantheon, you will find us. And if all else fails, you can find us at our website at thegeekpantheon.com, where you'll be able to find all of our podcasts, all of our blog posts. Well, there's not very many yet, but we're working on that.
Yeah.
And all of our other content.
Indeed. So this week in news from Wizards of the Coast, we have obviously had the kind of launch, the pre-launch, the friendly local game store launch of Xanathar's Guide to Everything.
It's awesome.
Yes, it is. Normally, we try to pump out a review in the window between the local game store launch and the wide launch, for those of you that may be on the fence about it. This book is like the densest, richest cake that you could ever imagine. Like, I read 5 pages of this book and I'm exhausted in a good way. There's just so much information in this book, and it would be a disservice to try and review it after reading it for a couple of days. So Philip and I,
it would need a multi-episode review.
Like, yeah.
We need to review the different sections of it individually because there's just so much.
Yes.
If you want more options, buy this book.
That's, yeah,
everything it is a giant Swiss Army knife of stuff for dungeon masters. It's got a lot of extremely handy stuff for dungeon masters, some very great character options. I, of course, am very happy to have it, as it finally gives me the official rules for everything I've built both of my characters in Eric's campaign out of.
And like 90% of the book is rollable table, which is just wonderful. Yeah. No, it's a phenomenal book. I would love to do a review style episode over it, but just giving it a bit of time, maybe call it less of a review and more of a diving into the book and just going over some of the highlights, maybe. But yes,
a review is, it's good. It's, yes, really good.
Very good.
It is worth the purchase cost.
I would say probably the strongest book they have released since the core launch, I would,
yeah,
say.
Absolutely.
So if you have not bought any other books, go buy this one. And if you don't want to pay the sticker price on a physical copy, you can head over to D&D Beyond and buy the, yep, digital copy for $20. So,
yep, PDF's $20, which is pretty good.
Yeah, that is obviously the big news from Wizards of the Coast. We also have gotten a new issue of Dragon Plus since our last episode, where there is a variety of things, a preview to Xanathar's Guide. So this goes into they actually do like an interview with Xanathar, which if you don't know who Xanathar is, he is a beholder that lives in Baldur's Gate, Waterdeep,
Waterdeep.
So if you want to go check out that exclusive interview, they label it as, go check that out. They have a article on the art of storytelling with D&D, which is cool. Another WizKids article about minis, where they are launching a classic creatures box set for WizKids minis, where they revisit some classic monsters and bring them to life. So that is very cool. And probably the highlight for me was the character spotlight, where they provide some tips on NPCs and using inspiration from the Waffle Crew over on Dice Camera Action and the Force Gray Lost City of Omu live stream that they do, pulling some NPCs from that and kind of highlighting their construction. So overall, good issue. Tragically, no adventure in this one, so that's kind of a bummer, but eh. So yeah, that's really all the news from Wizards of the Coast that I can find, Philip, unless you spotted something that I did not.
No, by the time this releases, there will be presumably a new Unearthed Arcana.
Yeah.
But we're recording Saturday before that release. And this will obviously come out on Tuesday, and we should have a new Unearthed Arcana on Monday. So we'll pick that up on.
So let's go into a new Unearthed Arcana, Philip. It was really good. Didn't you think that stuff?
Yes, I really enjoyed that it focused on the DM and or players.
Yes, it was sorely needed information relating to that class, race, or skill set. So,
and or game type, game pillar.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah, overall, thumbs up. Good job.
Yep. Check it out.
And we have a pick from the Dungeon Masters Guild this week from Philip.
Yeah, so I have this product, and it's on topic. There is a DM's Guild author, Tony Petreka, who's outstanding. I hope I'm pronouncing that name right. I'm never sure with two C's in a row. and he has some really outstanding products, some great adventures, as well as some great just products for DMs. But this one is called Dragons with an exclamation mark. There are technically two volumes of this, one on chromatic, one on metallic, or he has a bundle of them that's a better deal than buying both of them. The two volumes are $1.99 each, or you can buy the bundle for $3. The purpose of these is very simple. Back in previous editions, and especially in 4th edition, we got a lot of age categories for dragons, giving us a lot of incremental power rise for a dragon, so that you could basically find a dragon for any level of party. If you wanted to throw a dragon at them, you could really find one for a lot of different sizes of party or levels of party, and also gave you more options for dragons of specific sizes, which is sometimes of a concern, because you get a higher level party that the large sized of the dragon you want to throw at them isn't going to be powerful enough, but you don't have enough space in the encounter that you are imagining for like a huge or gargantuan monster. Gives you some options. Anyway, all this does is it provides more age categories. In the monster manual, we get 4 age categories: wormling, young, adult, and ancient. This adds several new categories, including very young, juvenile, young adult, old, worm, and great worm. So you get a greater variety, a lot more spread on what level of power you can put a dragon at. Like I say, I have both volumes, one's on chromatics and one's on metallics, and it's just a very, very simple utilitarian product at a pretty good price. Gives you some new monster options for dragons, which I always like having.
Sounds wonderful. I have not gotten a chance to read it yet, but it sounds like it would be a welcomed addition to any table.
Yep.
And lastly, one last thing we want to talk about. We are proudly members of the D20 Radio Network of podcasts, and you can head on over to d20radio.com, which is the best little gaming blog on the interwebs, where new articles go up daily about a variety of role-playing game systems. And on this episode, we want to highlight Ben Erickson's November 7th article from his workshop series titled The Dungeon Master's Dungeon, which is a conceptual dungeon. There's no mechanics here. It's all flavor, but it is a fun read where Ben has created the concept of a dungeon based around some TV shows that he grew up with, namely Double Dare, Legends of the Hidden Temple, and Guts. So those obstacle course style game shows where the flavor of it is a mad wizard having constructed this dungeon and then left, watches adventurers attempt to navigate it through scrying devices and is able to use magic mouth spells to speak to them, to welcome them to certain rooms, announce their failures, and celebrate their successes and award them the grand prize at the end. So I just love this concept. It's really funny to me. And if you do this, you absolutely have to be one of the rooms, be a puzzle that is just making a monkey statue, but it's only in three pieces and somehow the adventurers cannot get it. So yeah, I just spotted that and thought that it was a fun read, but definitely head on over to d20radio.com to check out all of the content. And also, still going on is the Kickstarter for Gamer Nation Con, which is the yearly con that D20 Radio puts on down in Plano, Texas. And it is the four best days of gaming that you could ever hope to attend. It is Thursday through Sunday, and it is literally nonstop gaming. And I can't speak highly enough about this convention. And we'll be there. And we'll be playing games. I'm probably going to be running some D&D. So if you want to come out and play some games, that would be awesome. If you head on over to our Facebook group, there is a link pinned at the top for the Gamer Nation Con 5 Kickstarter. It is currently well over its goal of $4,500 at 9,270. And I throw that number out there because the current stretch goal, if the Kickstarter can surpass $10,000, then everybody that attends the con will receive a handcrafted custom 12-inch wand. And so
the theme is Harry Potter.
Yeah, well, magic. It's Gamer Nation Con 5 and the Order of the Gamers. But yes, and because of that, there will be people running like Harry Potter flavored games and things like that. And so it'll be a lot of fun. And a 4-day pass to this convention is only $60. So yeah, definitely jump on that.
That deal is crazy.
Wow. So yeah. And also if you're out there and you sell merch for gamers, whether it's dice bags or minis or whatever, it's really affordable to come sell your stuff. There are only two slots left at Gamer Nation Con. But if you go to the Kickstarter and pledge $200, then you get two all access badges to the con and a vendor table, to sell for the entire convention. And you'll have your logo and company on d20radio.com. And you'll get a mention on the Order 66 podcast, which is the flagship podcast for D20 Radio. So yeah. Definitely go check it out. And if you feel like coming, hop on it.
Indeed.
Okay. Dragons.
Dragons.
Bah, 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 bah. Okay. So just starting off, Philip, let's go ahead and talk about dragons in the conventional vanilla 5th edition lore.
Okay. So dragon lore has obviously varies a little bit from place to place. 5th edition is a standard setting is Forgotten Realms, but previous editions have given us a sort of setting neutral lore for dragons, and so that's what I pulled together for this episode, rather than going more specifically. But most of this does apply in 5th edition. There are just some additional important characters in the lore, Forgotten Realms.
Yeah,
there's just some additional important characters in the lore. But we didn't want to go into exhaustive detail and do all of the important dragons. So we're going to talk about three the three big important sort of primordial dragon characters of D&D. That is Io, Tiamat, and Bahamut. Io is the less talked about one, but Io is the creator of the dragons. He's a primordial draconic god who's responsible for the creation of dragons. He's a neutral god of balance and order. And one of the reasons that he doesn't come up very often in adventures is because in most settings, he is dead. Or possibly she, in some settings, she is dead. Io is slain in battle with a primordial being that cleaves Io in half from head to tail. And from his or her death, from Io's death, rise Tiamat and Bahamut, who are born out of the two sides of Io's personality. Io is a being of balance. And so when Io is slain, balance is lost. And the two beings that rise from Io are going to become the antithesis of one another.
Yes.
With Bahamut being the ultimate lawful good being of order and goodness and the defense of the weak and all of the very classic positive aspects of heroes, and Tiamat being the opposite, being the chaotic, evil, villainous, multi-headed being of destruction and chaos who these beings are very primordial. So unlike a lot of D&D gods, we don't get as much personality from them. Yeah. It's more as though they're the embodiment of their ideas. And so Tiamat is essentially a being of entropy, a being of chaotic destruction. And Tiamat is a being of order. I'm sorry, Tiamat. Bahamut is a being of order and protection and preservation. How dragons become divided, because in standard lore, Tiamat is the ruler of chromatic evil dragons. And in standard D&D lore, all chromatic dragons are evil. And Bahamut is the ruler of all of the metallic dragons, who in standard D&D lore are good. In some settings, the implication is that Io is the creator of all dragons, and Tiamat deceives and draws to evil the chromatic ones.
Yeah.
In others, Tiamat and Bahamut are children of Io rather than being created by Io's death, and Tiamat is banished for being evil and goes to Earth, and there she seeds Earth with the chromatic dragons, which are not the creation of Io, instead are the creation of Tiamat in essentially a twisted imitation of what Io created, which are the metallic dragons. So in that sense, you get Tiamat in a much more Sauron and the orcs sort of thing. So there's a few different versions of exactly how this plays out. I actually like that, because that's true in most real mythologies. Real mythologies have differing versions of their creation story. You look at Greek mythology and where the gods come from, or Norse mythology. There's variants of the legend, variants on a theme. And so I kind of like the idea that as a dungeon master, if I was playing in a setting that I was going to use Tiamat and Bahamut, I would have both versions of this story appear.
Yeah.
So that it creates a much more realistic, I think, approach to mythology, to not just say, this is definitely what happened millions and millions of years ago in the at the dawn of time. We know with absolute certainty what happens. And probably I would also give followers of Tiamat their own version of this story that creates a more sympathetic view for Tiamat, because while Tiamat may be a sort of primordial embodiment of chaos and evil, her followers are not. And so if you are a human cultist of Tiamat, probably you don't look at Tiamat and say, you know what, this dragon over here, this dragon god is going to destroy the world. I'm so on board with that.
Yeah.
So that's the basic lore. There's a bunch of other cool draconic gods, and it would kind of be an episode in itself to explore all of draconic lore. You have, you know, Crenepsis, which is this god of judgment and law that sort of watches everything. And in some settings, draconic gods are like the specific pantheon worshipped by dragons.
Mm-hmm.
And in other settings, the draconic gods are just a part of the core god set, the core pantheon, happen to be draconic in nature. So how much you want to use draconic gods in the draconic mythology really depends on whether you're running a very dragon-focused campaign. Mm-hmm. A lot of the meat and detail of the draconic lore came to us through the really just, I've never had the guts to try to run this, but the wonderful setting of Council of Worms that was created back in second edition and then continued into third edition, where the players played as dragons.
Yeah.
And I think that sounds like an enormous amount of fun. I've just never had the guts to try to do it as a DM.
Yeah.
And so for that, a lot more detail was given to us about the sort of mythology of what dragons believe in.
Yeah.
So in many cases, you're never going to need this. It's going to be things that dragons know. But the core struggle between Tiamat and Bahamut and their creation by Io, that's sort of the central tension of dragons in D&D.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and diving into a bit more campaign-specific examples, because I like some ideas from other campaign settings and will pull them into my campaign even if they aren't natively born to my campaign or a homebrew setting. But in Eberron, which, in case you all haven't figured it out, is me and Philip's favorite setting, you have the continent of Argonessen, which is where the dragons live, along with some barbarian cults that guard the coastline and kill anything that tries to make land. But they're very reclusive, and dragons aren't out in the world generally. At least you would never know that they were, if they are. but we'll get into that in a bit. And they, a subsection of the dragons operate in the chamber, which is just playing into that idea of the life expectancy of dragons being so long, the dragons being these great manipulators that view the draconic prophecy and try to manipulate events or view events through a certain lens to confirm their own beliefs, kind of thing. Dragon mafia.
Another important change in Eberron is that, like most things in Eberron, there's no alignment fixed for different kinds of dragons. Chromatic dragons can be any alignment. Metallic dragons can be any alignment.
Yes.
And Tiamat is present. And one of the reasons dragons are so insular is Tiamat is bound. She's a demonic overlord, and she's bound. But the more that what the dragons have discovered is that the more they interfere in the wider world, the weaker the bonds on Tiamat grow. And so that's another fun tension that, again, it would have to be a very specific campaign for players to ever figure that out. But it's a fun piece of lore to have the dragons want to intervene for the good of the world or to manipulate the prophecy or to attain whatever they want, but knowing that every time they do so, it endangers everything.
Mm-hmm. so yeah, that's a brief overview of dragons in Eberron.
If you want to know more, there's a book called Dragons of Eberron.
Yes. Just touching on to Forgotten Realms a bit, just if you're interested in the history of the dragons and the culture, dragons are really rare in Forgotten Realms, if you didn't know, because the elves created a magical effect that caused all of the dragons in Faerûn to go mad and mindlessly destroy each other, including their offspring. And so that was an event called the Rage of Dragons. And yeah, it basically annihilated their population to the point where dragons are incredibly rare in Forgotten Realms. And the history of dragons across a lot of these settings seem similar. They warred with the giants, and then fell into civil war. Chromatic and metallic dragons attacked each other. And then they enslaved the elves, and the elves fought back. So it's very similar to Eberron. Other campaign settings, Dark Sun is probably the most unique use of dragons in any D&D campaign setting.
That's something we can almost always say about Dark Sun.
So they have the Dragon Kings. Only 9 dragons exist in the entire setting, and dragons are not their own being. For those of you unfamiliar with Dark Sun, there are 2 types of magic users, Defilers and Preservers. Defilers use the natural world and destroy it to fuel their own magic, whereas Preservers don't do that. They preserve the world. But Defilers, as they grow more powerful, take on more and more draconic traits until they hit a point where they just transform into a dragon. There's only 1 actual fully transformed Defiler in Dark Sun, the Dragon of Tyr, also known as Boris, which I that moment to me would be so wonderful, of like the Dragon of Tyr and this really ominous thing, and somebody finds out his real name of like, your name's Boris? No, I'm the Dragon of Tyr.
No, it's Niet. I am the Dragon of Tyr. Meet my mate, Natasha.
And then lastly, Greyhawk is probably the last like big D&D setting. Sorry if I have any Spelljammer. Yeah.
Spelljammer
fans.
Oriental Adventures.
Yeah. Spelljammer, Dragons in Space. But Greyhawk, it's probably the most like boilerplate, uninspired fairy tale type of dragon. They're bestial. They're not really intelligent. They roam the countryside. They are very common, though. If you are an adventurer with a sword in search of treasure, you're probably going to fight a dragon on every other adventure. So, yeah, those are just the various campaign settings. I really like Dark Sun. I obviously like Eberron. The lore behind dragons in Forgotten Realms is really interesting, though. So I would recommend going and reading all that stuff. I love reading lore from different settings just because they have some good ideas. So,
yep. Moving out of D&D lore to look at sort of where these things come from, we can look at fictional dragons. And there's kind of 2 big categories into which fictional dragons fall, and they're either the intelligent, scheming dragon or the more bestial dragon.
Mm-hmm.
And the intelligent dragons are our main archetype, of course, for Western intelligent dragons. For modern fantasy, tends to be from Tolkien.
Smaug,
yes, Smaug the Golden. If you are a super nerd and have gone into the Silmarillion, you find Glaurung. The inherent thing about these dragons is there's 2 important things. Like, Glaurung is, of course, first off, Tolkien's dragons are like catastrophic in scale.
Yeah.
They're extremely rare, but they are just like massive in scale. Like, the biggest dragon in Tolkien and Caligon is large enough that when he falls, it crushes an entire city beneath him. So they're huge, massive. I mean, today we'd almost talk about them as kaiju, I think.
Yeah.
In scale. So not things that your average adventurer goes off and just fights. You've got to be pretty epic to deal with these dragons, or have some really good advice from a local bird. But while Glaurung is this really big, scary, enormous dragon, the main thing that he does, and I think this is why we think about one of the reasons we think about dragons in D&D the way we do, is that most of the things that Glaurung does are not like just burning and smashing. The place where Drek Glaurung really comes in is just his pure cruelty. He actually mind blanks the sister of one of the great heroes and curses her so that she's going to cause the death of her brother. And at the end of it, when he's slain, he gets this wonderful little like death speech in which he reveals all of his evil plot to the hero and causes the hero to collapse into very Germanic tragedy that Tolkien liked. Tolkien drew a lot of this from Norse views of dragons, but in those, dragons are intelligent, they're crafty, they're very cunning. The dialogue between Bilbo Baggins and Smaug is possibly my favorite passage in fantasy literature. because again, and I think that also gives us some of the other things that we tend to associate with dragons in D&D is Smaug is extremely vain. Like Bilbo manages to survive in the presence of Smaug for a really long time by just occasionally throwing some compliments his way. And Smaug gets so very pleased that he wants to show himself off. And so the willingness of Smaug to talk, I think, is an important lesson for us if we're going to play with the intelligent dragon, is that it's really boring if we walk into the lair and the first thing that happens is the super intelligent schemy dragon jumps out and attacks us and we immediately roll initiative.
Yeah.
You know, if you're going to play that kind of dragon, if you're going to play the cunning dragon, you need to show your players the cunning side of it.
Yeah, absolutely. No, and this goes back to us talking about like having your monsters talk. Like, how does the dragon feel about people being in its lair? Is it amused? Is it angered? Is it disgusted? Like, these are questions that need answers if you're going to be playing the intelligent dragon.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it just goes down to how does it view the, as it would say, lesser races?
Yeah. This is skipping around in our notes a little bit, but the other form of intelligent dragon we see are the Asian dragons.
Yes.
Which tend to be primarily benevolent.
Mm-hmm.
Wish granting and that sort of thing. Much more serpentine, usually don't have wings, but can still fly. So it's largely a tendency towards being benevolent, whereas Western dragons usually show up as bad guys.
Mm-hmm.
And just a variance in appearance as well. But that's a different mythos that you can draw from in crafting a dragon as well, is the dragons in Asian folklore.
Yes.
Or you could have a luck dragon.
Yeah.
Get yourself some, get Falcor going on.
Okay. And then obviously the other type, looking to Game of Thrones or Reign of Fire, the bestial, these are dragons that are animals, you know, the kind of dragons that we have in real life. So,
yeah,
you know. At least that's what History Channel taught me. So yeah, bestial dragons, these, once again, Greyhawk utilizes these quite a bit. They're a very powerful monster. And depending on your setting, like obviously Greyhawk, they are common. So most people at least aren't going to be shocked by the sight of a dragon. But if it's a setting, like just to look to it directly, like Westeros, where maybe your setting doesn't really have dragons, then the appearance of one is a literal game changer. These things should be devastating in their destruction and their endurance and just everything. They should be otherworldly.
They should be scary. Very scary.
Yeah.
Should be the primary attribute of them. Since you're not going to have them talk, you just need to play at the terrifying nature of it.
And come up with a reason why they hoard gold, like if they're bestial.
That's true.
Like
if they do, I mean, you could drop that, but if you're going to have bestial dragons hoarding gold, which I mean, a lot of adventurers are going to really be, if your players don't know that you're not going to have dragons hoard gold, really you should come out and say that because while the characters might not have any right to be disappointed when they get to the dragon's lair, slay the dragon in order to be good guys, like in order to save the village, and then don't find a whole bunch of gold lying around.
Yeah.
The players will feel some disappointment. So
on History Channel, it told me that dragons actually ate gold because that had something to do with their ability to breathe fire.
That was such a fun little fake documentary. I enjoyed that. I remember that.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, let's talk about using dragons. You wanna put some dragons in your campaign? And let's face it, who doesn't?
Yeah.
I, as a DM, have long agreed with Tolkien that a story just isn't worth telling if there aren't any dragons. and I find excuses to put dragons in my campaigns.
Yes, go back to building out the end of Philip's campaign episode.
Yeah. For a whole lot of reasons. I've always liked dragons, but also as a miniature painter, dragons are a really fun model to work with. So I enjoy having excuses to do that. Excuses to explain to my wife why I need to buy another gigantic dragon miniature. So let's talk about running them. So how do we use dragons, Eric?
Well, you could use them as the big, bad, evil guy. So obviously this is the end of the campaign. You're going to want to use an ancient level dragon, probably. Or if you're using the supplement that Philip highlighted, a great worm, if you just want to get bananas with it. But I mean, this dragon should follow all the guidelines that we laid out for you back in our doing a compelling villain.
Speaking of that, a great worm red dragon from this supplement is CR 30.
There you go. I mean, it should follow the guidelines that we went over with the villains, that you should absolutely not use a bestial dragon as your big, bad, evil guy. I would never do that. I'm not saying you should definitely not do that. But if you do that, it should be more like a natural disaster than a monster.
Yeah. Godzilla attacks your civilization.
A force of nature. But if you're doing an intelligent,
in which case you might want to look at the Tarrasque.
Yes. Yes. The big bad evil guy being a dragon, obviously wonderful. Dragons are wonderful to use as the grand manipulator, the mastermind kind of archetype, the one that has lots of pieces moving around. But the big difference is, unlike a lot of those mastermind type big bad evil guys, this one can stand up to your party in a fight. If you want a big bad evil guy that you can throw at the party multiple times over the course of the campaign and not really be worried about the party killing them unexpectedly, a dragon is a good one to use just because they're so powerful. And they have a lot of get out of jail free cards, especially in their lair.
One really fun thing you can do with this, because of one of the just very much established powers that intelligent dragons have in D&D, is to polymorph, is you can hide the fact that you're dealing with a dragon.
Yes.
So you can, the first couple times you encounter the main villain, the party might be under the impression that he's just a very powerful wizard or sorcerer or warlord or whatever. You can disguise the fact of him being a dragon because he's still going to have all the hit points and all the resiliency of a dragon. He's just going to appear in a human form.
Yeah.
And it can be a really cool payoff moment in the final confrontation when he or she finally reveals his true form, and you get that great, you know, end of Sleeping Beauty moment where Maleficent transforms herself into a dragon.
Yeah.
Which was really impactful to me as a kid.
Important point of distinction. Welcome to the reoccurring segment of Eric and Philip's House Rules. In the Monster Manual, it says that only metallic dragons have the ability to polymorph into humans.
Really?
I think it's to distinguish the fact that they were made by Io and chromatic dragons weren't. Philip and I
was not at all aware of that.
No, I was aware and I ignore it. All dragons can polymorph. So just in case anybody out there is listening and knew that, also is like, but yeah, we know. Or at least I
did. Well, I didn't. I know now.
And knowing
I did not go
is
and
half
examine
the battle.
All of the stat blocks before we got on here. But I did not know that.
Okay. So yeah, I mean, having the dragon hide in plain sight is a wonderful thing to do. So yeah. Philip, What the about lieutenants?
Next one down would be to have the dragon be a lieutenant.
Yep.
To be in service to some greater evil. Now, you can do both. I mean, you could have a grand evil dragon with some of that dragon's children or allies helping it. If you watch Critical Role, Matt Mercer's arc, where the party are fighting the Chroma Conclave, which is a cabal of evil chromatic dragons, you've got that going on. But dragons can also be in service to lesser beings for a variety of reasons. Maybe owing them a favor, maybe this being saved their life, maybe somehow the dragon is enslaved, and that creates an option for the players to try to break that enslavement and get the dragon as an ally.
Yeah.
Which, you know, who doesn't want that? if you are playing the classic alignment scheme, this could be a really fun thing to do by having a metallic dragon as a bad guy. And then the party discovers that the reason that it's this thing that's happening that should not be happening is that for some reason the dragon is enslaved or being coerced in some fashion. So then you've got an arc of rescuing this enslaved metallic dragon from whatever being it is that's enslaved it. So dragons can be lieutenants despite being extremely powerful. And I think that's it becomes a fun arc of what is it that's more powerful than this dragon that's pulling the strings.
Yeah. Well, and in spite of their stat blocks, dragons seem to be very easily enslaved and or mind controlled. Like, that's a pretty common thing to find.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot of artifacts surrounding that too.
Yeah.
Orbs of dragon kind, that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Fair enough.
Which also brings another fun thing into the game is you got this doomsday device that's allowing some evil wizard to control the dragons creates a fun, you have to stop him before he completes the ritual that combines all the orbs of dragon kind and gives him control over all the dragons in the world. Panic. So, and then last way we can use dragons. Well, not the last way. Another major way we can use dragons is just as a sideshow. Your players have been doing one thing, and you've decided, you know, I haven't done a dragon. Let's have a side adventure where you have to rescue a town from a dragon.
Mm-hmm.
It's very easy. You can do all of the same things. An enslaved dragon, just a plain evil dragon, classic dragon that steals princesses. You can do all the same stuff. But as in a more compact sideshow fashion.
Yeah. And sometimes that's a great way to do a dragon because especially a bestial dragon sometimes doesn't have a lot of legs. So if you want to incorporate that type of dragon, having them come upon a village and, hey, please help us. If they're a chaotic or neutral party, then we'll give you lots of gold, to stop this dragon. So yeah.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's talk mechanically about using a dragon in your game. So dragons have, you know, claws and bites and tail smashing and all that's really powerful.
Mm-hmm.
For basically at whatever level they're at, dragons tend to be quite a powerful monster for that level.
Yeah.
And usually are intended to be used as a solo monster. Lower level dragons, you can pair, have an encounter with like a couple of dragons who are siblings or something like that. And that can be really fun. But, you know, the classic way to do a dragon, because they're so tend to be very large and catastrophic and destructive, is to have a dragon and its minions or a dragon by itself as what you're dealing with. But there are four pretty uniquely draconic things that we tend to see in most dragon stat blocks in D&D. The first, I'm just going to go through them and we'll talk about them. It's their breath weapon. They can fly. They tend to have a fear aura. And most of them have some spell casting ability.
Yeah.
So breath weapon. The most classic thing you can have with a dragon.
Yeah, it's the thing. If it has that dragon designation as the type of creature, it's going to have a breath weapon. And it varies by dragon type. So
I mean, my table, for the record, I tend to play it where I will let a dragon of various colors use a different breath weapon. My players know this, so they're not caught off guard. That has some downsides, because one of the fun things, one of the sort of the fun meta things, is that characters who've been adventuring for a long time start to know what kind of breath weapon to expect from different colored dragons, and so yeah, know what kind of resistances you want if you're hunting this dragon. So if you do that, because I just really like fire breathing as a dragon thing. I've always found acid breath to be, or poison breath to be kind of, the visual doesn't do anything for me.
Yeah.
Like, it's entirely just probably a failure of my imagination. But the visual lacks a certain something. And so I tend not to use that. I can see ice breath. I can totally see lightning breath. Like, the just poison or acid breath, I just, especially poison breath.
It's Philip's own hang up. I can easily envision a poisonous cloud coming out of a dragon's gullet. So, you know.
The dragon just belched at me. Is that really what we're doing here?
Like, no, it didn't belch at you. It has halitosis. Okay, Philip, stop being a jerk about it.
Anyway, so I will play around with that sometimes and give a dragon an unexpected elemental type despite the color, largely just based on what. This is probably as much as anything based on the fact that I don't have a miniature of every color dragon.
And this is something like, and it, DMs out there will know their own tables.
Yeah.
But for me, if I were running a game and I said that a dragon was attacking a village, and one of the players' first question to the person was, what color was it? And I say blue. And they spend a lot of time doing the in-character stuff to justify why they would know it has lightning breath.
Mm-hmm.
Even if my intention was to do fire breath or something different with that dragon, I would probably back off of that because they put a lot of effort into rewarding them for doing it that way. Now, if one of the players just spouted off, well, you know, and there's no reason for them to know, and it's like, well, blue dragons have lightning breath, meta knowledge, then I'm going to feel less bad about it. But
I mean, if you're going to, If this is going to be a thing where the players are hunting the dragon, like, if players aren't caught off guard by that and you're going to do the dragon hunt, giving them the opportunity to find out what the dragon does should be a part of that.
And yeah.
So I would definitely have, if I was going to do something non-standard with it, I would definitely have the villager make that a part of his answer. You know, he came from the sky spouting fire or something like that.
And something to remember with, especially if you're throwing the big heavy dragons at the party, like the ancient level dragons, they're all designed to be a struggle for a party of four 20th level characters. Like, none of them are just CR 20, mm-hmm. Except maybe the red dragon. I think the red dragon might be, I don't know.
Red dragon's usually the highest.
Oh, well then never mind. But yeah, I don't think any of them are just CR 20. So keep that in mind, that if they are trying to do their due diligence to be prepared for the fight, I mean, pulling one over on them and causing the party to wipe when they did everything they could to prevent that is something that I wouldn't enjoy as a player, because you're dealing with the biggest of the bigs here. So,
But the breath weapon, I think, is something that, so breath weapon usually on the big dragons will often function on a recharge. I've got the Great Worm Red Dragon from my Dragons supplement. has a 50% recharge. Recharges on a 4-6. This is a 180-foot cone. Now, this is a CR-30 monster, so this is going to be exceptional. But I enjoy this. It's a 180-foot cone. The dexterity save to save against the damage is a 26 DC, and the damage is 24d12.
Wow.
For an average of 156 fire damage.
If you're sticking with core stuff, I mean, it's a 5-6 recharge on a red dragon.
Yeah.
90-foot cone, 24 DC, 26d6 fire damage, half on a successful save. So devastation is essentially the name of the game here.
And I think how you describe the breath weapon matters a lot.
Yeah.
Of any of the kinds. And this should, I go back to the reason I brought up Reign of Fire and Game of Thrones as the two examples there is I think that they both do a really good job of showing just what it would mean to fight something that breathes fire.
Yeah.
And I think you could do the same thing with breathing ice or lightning or poison. and one of the things I play with maps and miniatures. But even if you don't, I think one of the things that would be important is after the breath weapon, especially of a powerful dragon, if you're playing with a little, wormling or something like that, this is probably not going to be the case. But if you're playing with a powerful dragon, if you're doing the classic kind of dragon thing, after the breath weapon has gone off, the battlefield should be different.
Yeah, if you're fighting a fire dragon, a red dragon in a forest or a plain, then everything's about to go bad. Mm-hmm. For both sides, frankly.
Yeah.
that kind of activity, if you're fighting in a volcano, something's probably going to happen.
Ice breath should turn everything into difficult terrain.
Yeah.
I might have, if I'm having a dragon exhale a poison cloud, I might cause the poison cloud to stick around.
Yeah.
Or acid breath to sort of continue to eat away at things. Maybe not the players.
No, but if you're fighting on a
very powerful.
If you're fighting on a man-made surface and acid breath gets hit, then guess what the floor is about to do?
keep having it eat away at this, eat away at the bridge, eat away at the trees around you or whatever. But the aftermath of that needs to be a part of the battle going forward.
And with the exception of ice breath, part of your description of the aftermath of a breath weapon should always be the smell, because it's going to smell awful with any of these. I'm assuming poison.
I think that, that ability, because it's so the classic ability, means that you need to be ready to create a very dynamic environment for the encounter, because every time it recharges, the intention here is if your breath weapon recharges, you should use your breath weapon.
Yeah.
If the breath weapon recharges, then it's going to happen again and the battlefield is going to change more. Mm-hmm. And so you're going to have this constant dynamic battleground as the players fight. And I think that's a lot of the fun of using a dragon.
So yeah, their movement, is another big iconic aspect of flight, being the one that kind of transcends all of them. And this is a big thing with why dragons can be a very frustrating enemy, because they can get away pretty easily, because not only can they can fly very quickly.
Yeah. And there's not a lot of reason for dragons to land, like just mechanically speaking. Narratively, whatever. But if you're just, playing the dragon to win, and obviously that's not always what you should be doing, but if you're just playing the dragon to win, there's not a lot of reason to land.
Yeah.
And because 5th edition allows you to break your movement up, you should be making strafing runs.
Yeah.
If your strafing runs involve physical attacks, then keep in mind opportunity attacks and that sort of thing. Give your players all the stuff they deserve. But with breath weapon especially, I would totally be having these strafing runs going through, just burning through the place or freezing it or whatever we're doing.
Mm-hmm. But
I will say that as a DM, this is the thing I'm the worst at with dragons, is remembering the movement aspect of it. But that can make the fight really dynamic. It's also going to mean that you're going to need the more powerful dragon you're using, the bigger the battlefield you're going to need for it to actually feel like a fight with a dragon.
Yeah. And I mean, the big thing from a player standpoint, like, they're going to be trying to knock it prone because that's the only mm-hmm. thing to really combat flight, because they don't have a just innate hover. Another important thing to look at, though, just talking about flight, is there other types of movement? Because that's something that gets lost in the shuffle a lot. I mean, black dragons have a very fast swim speed. Blue dragons can burrow very quickly. Mm-hmm. And that's an aspect that I never would have, like, having a dragon go from flying to burrowing straight away. Like, yeah, they might need to land, but they land underground. So what's the party going to do?
And with swim speed and burrowing speed, both, there's quite a lot of ways to knock something prone. Like a fighter or a monk can theoretically just knock something prone with some of the abilities that they get through different archetypes. But to force something out of water is much harder.
Yeah.
And to force something to come up from underground is not quite impossible, but very, very difficult. You need some, like, earth moving magic.
Mm-hmm.
And especially because the players are going to think about flight.
Yeah.
Flight is what you think of with dragon. And I think you should use it because of that. But, where the dragon fights, and we'll talk about the lair here in a minute, should be able to let the dragon take advantage of its movement abilities.
Yeah.
The frightful presence is mm-hmm. something that that most dragons get from, let's see, when do they pick up this? Is it adulthood? I think it's, adult dragons pick up the frightful presence ability that is really potentially really devastating.
Oh, yeah.
Because if you fail that save, you become frightened for quite a bit. With adult dragons, it's a minute.
Yep.
And you get the save every turn, but every turn that you have not saved, you are running double your speed away. You are dashing away.
Yeah.
And depending on how far you get away, that's X number of rounds to get back.
And it doesn't say, like, a lot of auras or presences once you're outside of the effect it ends. No, it continues with you. Mm-hmm. And when you're fighting an ancient red dragon, that DC is 21 wisdom. That's not nothing.
This is where, if you're a player listening to this, this is why you want things that make you immune to fear.
Yes.
Hero's Feast, having a paladin nearby, that sort of stuff is really, really helpful.
Mm-hmm.
And then, so a lot of dragons in, I'm not talking towards my thing. Let me start this again. So it's not as much a thing in 5th edition, but in previous editions, lots of dragons were also spellcasters.
Mm-hmm.
To represent their intelligence.
And if you look to the sidebar on page, 86 of the Monster Manual, it does give you the variant on how to introduce spellcasting to your dragons if you want to reintroduce that.
So how would you do this, Eric? What would you do?
Are you talking about the variant rules?
What do you think? You think better for dragons to have spells, or dragons enough without it?
I'm always leery of spells just because I tend to not use them as effectively. There's a story from a campaign that Philip and I were playing in previously where one of our players who plays wizards and spellcasters glanced at the monster card of the monster I was running and looked to Philip, I think, and said, I could have killed our party in one round with this guy. So I like the dragons as they are built. I think that you have to be very flavorful in how they affect the environment. Describing the breath weapon, having them fly around for it to be more than just a sack of hit points. And if you want to ensure a variety in your encounter with the mechanics, then I think this variant with the spell casting can be helpful if you want to stick to rules as written in the Monster Manual using this variant is a good thing to introduce some variety.
Yeah. I would say I would not populate a spell list like in the standard fashion. I would select some spells that I'm going to use.
Yeah.
That would be allowed by the rules. Like, again, if I'm sticking by the rules, I would make sure that the spells I'm selecting are within the parameters. But just pick some spells that you think he should have that are going to be useful for him, and just know how those work.
Yeah.
Because you've got enough to keep track of with a dragon.
Yeah, I mean, just if you are using a red dragon, and I mean, pulling one from Xanathar's Guide to Everything, if you're using the spell casting and Immolate is not on the spell list of your ancient red dragon, go put that one on there.
Make it thematic spells.
Yeah. There is a better option, though, I think, outside of the rules.
Oh, first, one thing that it occurs to me just now.
Okay.
There used to, in previous editions, and maybe one day in fifth edition there will be, in previous editions there were a whole lot of other kinds of dragons other than the colors and stuff. And there are still kind of, there are, you can still have, you know, a shadow dragon as a variant of a dragon, that sort of stuff. But if you're trying to do that, if you want to do a shadow dragon or a primordial dragon or an elemental dragon of some kind.
A gem dragon.
A gem dragon, yeah, crystal dragon. Some of the spells would be a really excellent way to distinguish that dragon from the regular dragon. Give a shadow dragon the ability to cast a bunch of darkness-related spells. And that way, in addition to the visual difference and some of the mechanical differences of the shadow dragon, you also are going to get some very specific abilities that are going to highlight the fact that what you're fighting right now is a different kind of dragon. And also, if you wanted to make a dragon that's like an elemental being instead of your standard dragon, this is a dragon that's like made of earth. If you play Guild Wars 2, the way the dragons in that look are very elemental dragons, then you could use spells to represent that again. So spellcasting gives you some ways to create variant dragons without actually having to rebuild the dragon.
And, I mean, there are other very flavorful spells that you can just pull from to create a different type of breath weapon if you just want that to... I mean, glancing right across the page from Immolation and Xanathar's Guide, there's a spell called Infestation, where a cloud of mites, fleas, and other parasites appear. Having a dragon...
An undead dragon, yeah.
Yeah.
Or like a plague dragon.
Yes. Having them spew that at the party would be very disturbing. So... yeah, just look at the spells and get creative with it. I will say, though, those of you listening to this podcast and are not watching Matt Colville's YouTube channel are doing yourself a disservice. Go over and check out his channel, but go watch his episode on 4th edition and what we can take away from that for 5th edition, because he describes a fight with a dragon and using some abilities found in 4th edition to make that fight more dynamic, more interesting, and harder by using abilities or powers rather than spells.
Yeah. So one of the things that I like from, and Colville's talked about this, and me and Eric have talked about this, monsters aren't human adventurers or humanoid adventurers. And so monsters are going to have, just like a dragon's breath weapon is very different from any kind of breath weapon or fireball that a human wizard can cast. So dragons have unique abilities based on being a dragon.
Yeah.
And I think that one option other than spellcasting would be, say, rather than this dragon became a wizard, or was born a sorcerer. You could totally do that. That's a very viable way, especially when giving the dragons the ability to like become humanoid, like polymorph, then making their human side a wizard is fun. But if you want a really powerful dragon or a really unique dragon, then give your, just create a power that your dragon can use. Decide how many times the dragon can use it, or give it a recharge or something like that.
Okay, so for example, looking at the black dragon in 5th edition, it's got its ancient black dragon specifically. It's got its acid breath, it's got its frightful presence, and that's it outside of its melee attack abilities, bite, claw, and tail. Looking at 4th edition, now granted, it was more powerful. It was level 26 as opposed to 21 in 5e. But it has bite, claw, and tail. It has an ability called Acid Gloom, where it creates a zone of acidic darkness that remains in place until the end of the dragon's next turn. It blinds everything, and they take acid damage. It's got its breath weapon, its frightful presence, and then another ability called Vitriolic Spray, where it basically spits acid in a target's eye. So it kind of takes the idea behind its breath weapon that it could spit acid, but focuses it on one creature. And the attack on it is, it gets a plus 28 to its attack roll on, like, that's devastating. That's so powerful. I mean, for bite, claw, and tail in 5th edition, it only gets a plus 15. So, yeah, I mean, finding ways to take the breath weapon and take that idea of, okay, lightning can come out of a blue dragon's mouth. So how can we make that interesting? Outside of it just opening its mouth and lightning comes out. Or, I mean, just sticking with the theme, ancient blue dragons in 4th edition can smack their wings together to create a thunderclap, which can stun all nearby targets. So, I mean, honestly, just go to 4th edition and just pull these abilities off the monster card, because I know 4E gets a lot of flack from a lot of players, but one thing they did right was interesting and unique abilities for monsters. I mean, I think they did a lot more than that right, but that's another discussion for another time.
Yeah, shadow dragons breathe necrotic energy instead of whatever their normal energy would be. One thing that I would do with that is, since it's a shadow dragon, is I would consider having the breath weapon of the dragon create a zone of darkness, a la the darkness spell.
Yeah.
Additionally, because the shadow dragon has a lot of powers that key off of being in dim light or darkness, this would allow the shadow dragon to create a battlefield more suited to itself, just as other dragons are, of course, tend to be immune to their breath weapon type. I would allow it, and creating fire is beneficial to the fire dragon. I would allow the black dragon to create dark, the shadow dragon to create darkness, things like that. So there's lots of ways that you can tweak the dragon to make the experience very unique.
Yeah,
without having to memorize the mechanics of a bunch of spells.
Yeah, and that's the nice thing about creating abilities or powers or just passive things, like something that just popped into my head. Red dragons can shoot fire. They live in volcanoes. So presumably, they run a little hot in terms of body temperature. So, I mean, what if on a melee attack that you have to make a dexterity saving throw to not get burned by the blood? Like, the blood is literally boiling hot. And so if you just stab wrist deep into the dragon, your hand's going to have third-degree burns on it. I mean, that's something that you can just add to the monster card and just not have to worry about using. It's just there.
If you want to make it, like, genuinely harder, one thing you could do with a red dragon is let it give it some kind of regeneration while in fire.
Yeah.
So it sets an area of the forest on fire with its breath weapon, and then hangs out in that fire.
Yeah.
Granting it regeneration. Like, lots of ways to make the dragon. I mean, the dragon's plenty interesting as it is, but there's lots of ways that you can add things to the dragon that will make any dragon encounter very dynamic. And that's really what you want. You don't want a dragon encounter to ever be mundane.
Yes. And dragons should, I mean, we'll get into this in the flavor, But more so than most any other monster you're going to use, dragons should be smart. Mm-hmm. You should kind of fight to win when you're fighting a dragon, because they are long lived, especially an ancient dragon. If you're dealing with just a young dragon, they can be hot headed and brash and dumb. But the ancient dragons,
especially fire dragons, you know,
Waka waka waka. But ancient dragons, they're ancient for a reason. I mean, in the monster manual, it says that ancient dragons are 801 years or older. Your party is probably not the first people that have tried to kill it. And so it knows its way around a fight. So maybe that's a good opportunity to slide into personalities.
Yeah. So dragons have near immortality. That gives them a very different viewpoint on the world.
Yes.
They're not going to think in short-term goals. Mostly, if you want a dragon that's unusual, that's obviously dragon can have any personality that fits what you want to do with it. But beings that are going to live as long as a dragon is going to live, they're not going to look on human settlements and think about the value of this human settlement because it's been here for six generations.
Yeah.
That's nothing.
Another aspect of dragons that they talk about in, I think specifically metallic dragons, is they associate strongly with bloodlines. And so you may be a lawful good paladin, but your great grandfather just so happened to be a thief that stole from this dragon, and he can sniff that out. And so he's not going to be a fan of yours because of your bloodline, because of what your family has done. But just an interesting thing is most D&D campaign settings, the known history, like once you're out of folklore and fairy tales and mythology, I mean, it's maybe 1,000 years, maybe 2 if we're dealing with a really long setting. So it's not inconceivable to have a dragon that has witnessed the entirety of quote unquote known history. And so in Eberron, something like the last war that lasted 100 years, that's nothing. That's a squabble. When the party is interacting with these dragons, I mean, if the party has any level of sense of urgency, that's going to be lost on the dragon in a heartbeat.
One of the things you might consider with a good dragon, if you're dealing with a dragon as kind of a patron, it just doesn't have any sense of the urgency. And so this, you know, brass dragon that the party is aiding just really wants to hear their story in minute detail, starting with their births.
Yeah.
Because that wasn't that long ago. And he just has no sense of, like, you know, the bad guy is going to finish his ritual in, you know, 3 days. We really got to move here. Because if the bad guy finishes his ritual, unless it's like legitimately world ending or a direct threat to the dragon, it's probably a temporary inconvenience to this being. It's inhuman. It doesn't have the same values and personality traits, even if it's good aligned. It's still not human. It doesn't think, it shouldn't think the way a human does.
Yeah. I mean, I think the best analogy that I can come up with is, I mean, next time you're walking outside, look down to the ants that crawl across the sidewalk, and how much regard do you give them and their struggles and their life even? That's probably about the same relation to your character and a dragon, like, except you can talk, which is cute. Every player race, with the exception of maybe elves, live such an insignificant amount of time and do things of such little significance to the broader scope from a dragon's perspective that it just doesn't matter. Like, it's no great tragedy that an anthill gets stepped on. So why should the dragon weep for your loss? So,
yeah. And a dragon destroying a town may be doing it because he's malicious and cruel. That's fine. You know, maybe he's the kid, you know, burning ants with a magnifying glass, because he enjoys watching them shrivel up.
Yeah.
But maybe also these are pests who've infested his lawn.
Yeah. No, I mean, that's great. I feel like we can get a lot of traction out of this analogy right now. Yeah. but yeah. And I mean that, yeah, they're just inhuman. I don't know how else to further go into this topic. So dragons and their hoarded gold. If you look to the monster manual, it's just an impulse for them. There's no real rhyme or reason. Especially with the chromatic dragons, they love gold. With the metallic dragons, it's more altruistic in preservation of knowledge or guarding evil artifacts and things like that from the world, which is more interesting to me.
Dragons are hoarders. I mean,
yeah, just very, very fancy, away. Fancy hoarders.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, they're not going on a shopping spree. They're not going to outfit an army. They might, like, you could always have them do that, but rules as written, they just collect because they want to collect.
And this, you know, this makes a certain amount of sense. Again, if we can tie this to their longevity, is these are just neat things. I found these neat things.
Look at this stuff. Isn't it neat? Wouldn't you say my collection's complete?
Which means you should really take some time in designing a dragon horde, especially if it's like an important adventure. Take some time in designing a dragon horde. Find some neat things that can be thrown in there. Not like just powerful things. Obviously the players expect that. And not just valuable things, but just odd things. Things the dragon thought were really cool, but maybe didn't understand their function or, you know, and remember that the dragon being large is also not going to make the same use out of all of the treasure, if it makes any use at all, that you and I would. So maybe the dragon has, you know, created itself some earrings out of gigantic dinner trays or something.
Or that epic level artifact spear that like contains the soul of your grandfather is its toothpick. Like,
All right. So, a couple more things about using dragons especially as a DM, are minions and lairs. And really we've talked about minions extensively on when we talked about our boss fights. And so, you know, but the classic minions are other things that are draconic or reptilian.
Kobolds.
Lizard folk, dragonborn. The dragon picks minions that are kind of like itself. Seems to be the norm. It doesn't have to be. Dragon can have any kind of minion you want. It could also have enthralled people that it's captured. That's a fun and really, really terribly evil thing to do is have the whole village that's endangered. The way they're endangered is not the dragon's burning it down. It's the dragon's enthralled them all. The dragon has used powerful magic to force them to behave in the way that it amuses. It's using the... I just had the idea of your great villainous dragon is essentially playing The Sims.
Yep.
Have thralls or worshippers.
Yeah.
Things of this power are going to sometimes be perceived as godlike. And especially, you know, kobolds are specifically known for worshiping dragons. Dragonborn are going to have a worship relationship with a dragon. So having the dragon be treated by its minions as godlike is very, very fitting.
Yeah, so like a lot of high-level monsters that you deal with in 5th edition, it has kind of these iconic lairs that they dwell in, and if the party attacks them in it, they're going to have a bad day because they have lair actions. And, I mean, the lair, I think, should be very indicative of the type of dragon and its personality also. I mean, is it meticulously well kept? Is the horde organized, or is it just ramshackled together? But I mean, definitely there are far too many to go over all of them in this episode.
Sure.
But go look at the lair actions for each type of dragon, because they do vary greatly. And also the regional effects. That's another really fun thing, is that like some of them are like 6 miles away from the dragon's lair, this crazy thing happens, so the party knows they're on the right way.
I would say also the lair, I mentioned this with movement, but the lair should give an opportunity to use the dragon's movement.
Yeah.
A black dragon's lair should be, you know, in a swamp or something.
Yeah.
Maybe it's in the branches of this gigantic swamp tree. And for, you know, miles around it, the dragon has worked these channels that it can swim up and down so that it can harry the party as they get near its lair.
Yeah.
Lair doesn't have to be a cave. You know, that's the classic thing. But it doesn't have to be that simple.
No. And it could be that simple, but with an interesting twist. I mean, the blue dragons live in crystal caves that they form with their lightning breath.
Mm-hmm.
So
they can burrow. So that blue dragon should be going in and out of the walls.
Yes. The lair should almost be a character unto itself. I mean, mostly because it has its own initiative count. So, but give the lair personality. Don't just have it be a cave at the base of a volcano with a giant pile of gold and that's it.
Yeah.
The ancient red dragon's lair should be the volcano, not a cave near the volcano.
And because of that, it should be unbearably hot.
Yes.
Like, the party is going to need magic to be able to walk into this cave without at least suffering exhaustion, or perhaps actively suffering damage as they go.
Yeah. All right. So dragons and players.
So we have two draconic races. Dragonborn, which are a standard player race in the in the player's guide, and kobolds. And we have stats for player kobolds. It's definitely not designed for play yet.
Yeah.
You got a -2 to your strength. So, you know, buyer beware. But if I'm a dungeon master and a player wants to play a kobold, I would probably tweak the stats to make it a little more on par with like a gnome or something.
Yeah.
But the kobold is not designed for a player, but there's a lot of fun you can have playing a kobold.
Mm-hmm.
But think about if you're playing that, if you're doing a kobold or a dragonborn or even a lizard folk, perhaps, because those were added in Volo. Think about, what is your player's relationship to draconic entities? How does your player feel about dragons? If you're a dragonborn, are you comfortable hunting dragons? Maybe, but you should understand that. Think about that. Think about why. Especially with dragonborn and kobolds, because both, in a lot of settings, their mythology assumes that they were in some fashion created by the dragons. Either by one of the draconic gods or by dragons themselves. There's a lot of different versions of this, but all of them tend to tie their creation to the dragons, except in, I think in Forgotten Realms, dragonborn are created by a wizard.
Mm.
I think.
Maybe. I don't know.
I don't, anyway.
You mentioning lizard folk, I pulled them up in Volo's guide, and they have a rollable table for quirks. And one of them is, you recently learned to laugh. Use this talent in response to all emotional situations to better fit in with your comrades. Sorry, just had to share that real quick.
That's really delightful.
Just like a lot of races, there are some important questions that you have to ask yourself in regards to how this race interacts with the world and with a draconic blooded character like a kobold or a dragonborn that has to include dragons.
Some ways that players can interact with dragons are pretty normal. Dragons, you might worship Bahamut or Tiamat, and you don't have to be a draconic character to do that. The Paladin of Bahamut is sort of the classic lawful good paladin in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
So you could be a worshiper of one of these draconic gods, in which case, if you're not a dragonborn or a kobold, why do you worship a draconic god? Like, as you know, go back and look at our talk about divine characters and things like that, and that we've done over the over time, and gods. But think about why. Dragons can also be a great patron. Like the big bad evil guy, this can be done by hiding, while you're hiding the fact that the dragons are a patron. Me and Eric did this in Unfinished Wars. One of the early patrons of the party was a disguised dragon.
Mm-hmm.
But dragons can be a really good patron. Speaking of that, there needs to be a dragon patron for a warlock.
Yeah.
That's a significant absence.
Yeah.
It just occurred to me that troubles me. and then, of course, there's the classic as a player. You might be a dragon hunter. This could be a real fun monster of the week kind of thing where you play a party whose function is dragon hunters. You can be Matthew McConaughey from Reign of Fire.
Yes.
Party O Dragon Hunters.
Mm-hmm.
Or Dennis Quaid from Dragonheart.
Oh, God.
there are so many good people in that, and it's so bad.
And there are a couple, one of them is still Unearthed Arcana. One of them was introduced in Xanathar's Guide to Everything. But the Monster Hunter, the fighter subclass that was released back in the Gothic Heroes UA, and then the Monster Slayer Ranger subclass would be very flavorful and mechanically good ones if you wanted to be a dragon hunter.
Mm-hmm.
Those would fit very well in that.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, that, especially in a setting like Greyhawk where they're bestial and plentiful, I mean, mm-hmm. you could make a good living being I immediately jumped to like a Ghostbuster style premise where you're just working class dudes going out killing dragons. You know, it's your day job. It's not anything romantic or fancy. It's just what we do. So, yeah. Anyway, I think we have talked about this topic quite a bit, Philip.
Yes.
So, yeah, we hope you all enjoyed this episode over probably the most iconic monster in the game since it's in the name of it.
Mm-hmm.
Let us know what you thought over on the Facebook group.
I'd really love to hear your stories about dragon battles.
Yes.
As a DM or as a player.
Yes, please let us know crazy, crazy things that have happened with dragons in your campaigns. I don't really have any super crazy. Well, we had an undead dragon go ham on a city in a campaign,
yeah.
But we talked about that. Let us know. Also, let us know what you would like to hear about. If you have any questions about the system, any issues that have come up at your table, let us know, and we will do our best to talk about them at least. Maybe not give satisfying answers or solve them, but we'll talk about them. Anything else, Philip?
I think that's it.
All right. Thank you all so much for listening to the Knowledge Check podcast. Once again, I am one of your hosts, Eric.
I'm your other host, Philip.
We'll see you next time.
Bye-bye.